Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And it's time for Destroy All Culture episode 231, taking place partially on the surface of the sun this week. I'm Adam P. Nave. With me as always is Hayden Morgan.
Yowza!
Yowza! It's a hot one.
It's a hot one. It's hot. It's hot out there.
And that's like it really will break 100 while we're recording this.
That's the truth, Ruth.
Anyway, we took last week off for life reasons, but now we're back.
We're back. I don't know what those life reasons were, but we took them.
I don't remember either, actually.
I think I'd had my vaccine shot the day before.
Oh, right.
And I was just kind of like, I wasn't feeling sick. I was just kind of in
out of it.
Land.
Yeah.
Like, who's the podcast? Woo. So now I'm all fully vaccinated, and I'm Ooh. 1 week away from reaching, big old immunity.
Just in time for the Delta variant. Anyway,
just in time for the one thing that's probably going to cause breakthrough cases. Yes.
Yeah, actually, there was some interesting reporting that again, it's one of these. There's a lot of news stories where you have to hunt for the bad variable.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, you know, in Israel, the Delta variant. Like half of the people in this breakout of Delta variant cases were vaccinated. And it's like, okay, but there were no numbers for how many people. In total, and it didn't mention that something like 85-90% of Israel is vaccinated, so of course it'll skew the number.
Right.
But again, it's if it's 10 people got sick, and half of them, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And vaccinated people who are becoming sick from Delta variant or any variant of COVID are not experiencing like the degrees of hospitalization,
right?
Illness.
That's the thing. It's like it was very light on facts, and I was just getting madder and madder. Anyway, we have at least three things I know we want to talk about. One we forgot to mention in our little pre-show, like, hey, what should we talk about?
Oh.
So before we get to any of that, actually, like four things. Before we get to any of that, though, I just want to. Okay. So there's been this pandemic. I don't know if you heard.
There's been a pandemic.
And of course, the biggest problem, you know, sure, over 500,000 people dead globally, but Hollywood has been hurting. And we all know that's what actually matters to people.
Right, of course.
I don't know why I'm being a dick today. Anyway, I'm in a mood. It's hot. So, you know, like, they opened up movie theaters twice before they really should have, and they've been having trouble getting people back into movie theaters.
Right.
So every movie that comes out, obviously, they've been going, you know, like, well, whether it comes out as a mix of, like, you know, streaming and in a theater or just in a theater, like, you know, it's still, we're doing the best we can, and that's fair. Right? Like, no one expects anything else.
Exactly.
Right? Like, no one is out there thinking, well, this is gonna be a fucking runaway hit. Okay?
Right.
So, like, A Quiet Place Part 2 opened to $47 million, which I think is actually really good considering.
Sure.
Back in May 28th. June 16th, Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, which, I mean, fuck that movie. The first one was kind of cute and not cute enough to ask for a sequel, but you'd figure that under normal circumstances, people would be like, oh, I would go see a sequel. I saw the first one. Opened June 16th to $11 million domestic.
That's actually better than I thought it was going to do, frankly.
Okay. So both those movies this weekend, A Quiet Place Part 2, and again, it's been out for a little bit, mm-hmm. still pulled in another $6 million.
Okay.
Still respectable. Like a week or two after its opening, Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard pulled in like $4.9 million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So F9, as it is known, Actually, officially, the official title is F9 The Fast Saga, which is a brand new thing. Open this weekend.
And?
To the tune of 70 million.
Holy shit.
Right. Like, this is hitting, like, and again, like, for these movies, it's still hitting, like, half of, like, at least.
Yeah.
Like, less than half, but still. This thing just blew everything else out of the water. The Sunday totals, like, the estimates, have everything else below 2 and Fast 9 sitting at 17.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah. Like, I don't, I mean, and again, like, I know that I was thinking, like, you know, I'm really sad that I'm not feeling up, like, safe going to a theater yet. But holy shit, everyone just showed up for that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's what you'd expect from, like, oh, we just, like, this is what Disney hopes for with, like, Black Widow, right? And they won't get it. But it's what they hope for with Black Widow.
Right.
And again, partially they won't get it because it'll also be on Disney Plus, but they'll get $30 a shot for it from people. So
Sure.
But yeah, no, I was not expecting to see that 70. Because it's not like it was the first thing to open wholly in theaters either, like Quiet Place did and all that. So did Hitman's Bodyguard, which is why I picked those. And again, like, Quiet Place doing 45 is not bad for, like, again, it's about half, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, being like a little bit under half, it reminds you what a juggernaut those Fast and Furious movies can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is impressive and crazy.
Isn't it? I thought you would enjoy that. A little bit of number wonkery.
Yeah. No, I do like me some number wonkery. Yeah, because I was looking at movie list, like, I while you were talking, I thought, oh, I'll look up the movie listings for my town. And I realize I haven't looked at movie listings in at least a year. So, rather strange.
Yeah, I haven't opened, like, my Cinemark app, because I always go to this one Cinemark theater and I haven't opened it. I get mail from them still. I love that, like, over the last year, they keep sending me out, like, your points are being extended. And I'm like, no shit. Like, you're closed. I couldn't use them if I wanted. Like, what kind of dicks are you?
Ooh, hey, down at the Kramer IMAX Theater, there's a documentary on beavers playing. It's called Beavers.
Nice.
Yeah. Not so bad.
I don't even, like, this is going to sound weird. I don't even really know where did my Cinemark app go? There it is. Like, it's been so long. Let's see what's playing, if it'll actually load. I should not have, like, started doing this while we were talking, because this is going to take a minute. Oh, dear God. Anyway, let's just find stuff. So, yeah, I just, like I said, I was just kind of impressed.
I gotta say.
And, yeah.
So, oh, hey,
Yeah, no, it of course has Fast 9 and all that bullshit.
Yeah.
And A Quiet Place 2. I don't know what some of these movies are. 12 Mighty Orphans. Is that a movie?
it's pretending to be a movie. Let's say it's a movie.
Huh. I swear, I just saw that in, like, The Conjuring is there. There's a movie called 12 Mighty Orphans.
There.
Which I think is, like, I don't know if it's, like, 12 Ducks. Mighty Ducks? I don't even fucking know. I don't care. Anyway, putting that shit down. Speaking of orphans, how's that for a segue?
Oh, yeah, nice one.
The thing we forgot to mention that we want to talk about was there were a couple episodes of Legends.
Oh, right. How could we forget? Oh, yeah.
There were some strange-ass episodes of Legends.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one, of course, the one that I was foremost in my mind is the most recent one, in which...
Right.
Which Ava, oh my God, Sarah, thank you. Ava and Sarah, where Sarah finally gets back from her planet with the megalomaniac bishop. That was great. I loved that episode, mostly because the entire plot with the Legends revolved around them sitting in an Indian restaurant, Nate eating plate after plate of food, and them mushroom curry, and them accomplishing absolutely nothing of note at all.
Right.
Except for Spooner, who accidentally ended up talking to Sarah anyway, and providing a glitch in the recording, but that didn't actually make any real difference. It was just a little sort of grace note in the proceedings.
Right, and of course, like their great terrible plan that they come up with, then gives us escape from Constantine. I don't know what to even call that version of Nate. That was amazing. entire episode was just like, it was so weird.
Yeah, it was like they threw in Snake Plissken and then put the Constantine trench coat on him and said, okay, let's go with that.
Yeah, but I do love the conceit that, it's kind of, this is sort of, we always see the legends do stuff. And you know, obviously, right? It's their show. And they always say, they screw stuff up for the worst, but they always seem to kind of squeak by. But you have to have that sense of, a lot of times, this is what actually happens. Right. That they just don't bother filming. You know, in that sense, right? These are the adventures we don't see. And a lot of shows, after a while, you get these are the adventures we don't see. And usually they're they're quieter or they're quicker. And you're oh, that's why we don't see them. This time she's no, because they're fucking idiots. And you're yeah, okay, I get it.
They've really been leaning into that lately. In this season especially. They're just presenting them. Ava and Sarah actually seem to know what they're doing, but the rest of them are just bumbling and enmeshed in their personal nonsense. And
that is the show.
Yeah, and just they're like if a whole bunch of friends that you try not to keep in touch with suddenly all show up at your house at once, that this is what the legends are. They're those people. Just
it's funny
because
there are any number of shows. And you know, to loop back to the Fast and Furious movies, that are a found family, right?
Right.
And sure, you always get the sense okay, these characters like each other and all that, but this is one of the only shows that feels like this found family of in terms of it's that bunch of idiots who can't really escape.
Right.
And they kind of mean well most of the time, except when they don't, I guess.
Yeah, which they. And they usually mean well, so that's...
They usually mean well.
We'll give them a pass. But yeah, that was... the last one was a delight. Also, just perfect for Pride Month, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah,
I do have a bet for, where this is going.
Please.
And again, keep in mind, I don't watch, any of the... So I don't know if... Because I feel like this is a big enough thing that, if there is a next episode thing, this would spoil it. But I Bishop has to have put part of his brain in either Gary or Sarah.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing Sarah because Gary was never really under his control.
Right.
They have to play with the "Am I really me?" of it way more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way to do it.
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely it. Maybe she's a sleeper agent, or thinks she's a sleeper agent, or. You know, or whatever, but they'll probably do it in some way that I'm not expecting, because it's Legends. But yeah, I can't think of anything where else to go.
Yeah.
Or maybe they'll be like, "Well, that's done."
And they still have I don't know, a couple episodes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's weird actually. All these I believe Batwoman is coming to a close in a couple of episodes.
I think next episode.
Is the next episode? Holy crow.
I think. Here's the thing. Is that this was episode 7 of Legends.
Mm-hmm.
They go to 15.
Jeez.
So, we still have a while.
This is true. Plenty of things to happen.
Yeah, Batwoman, I thought still had a couple episodes.
I think there's one on the 13th, and then one on the 27th, or something like that. Maybe that's Superman and Lois.
Yeah, because I think it's June 27th. It's episode 18.
Oh, jeez.
Is it?
Huh. Huh.
Yeah, Superman and Lois, I think, has like two more.
Right. Sorry, it was Superman and Lois that I was thinking of. So I guess I have to, but that's good because this releases me from the burden of watching Batwoman for a while.
I like the show, and I also don't like watching the show, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Like, I don't know that I'm going to keep doing it. It's too much Arrow for me.
It is very, that is clearly their, like, ultra-serious, dark replacement Arrow.
Right, and I just, I mean, especially, like, Flash gets dour enough.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm like, I guess I'll watch Flash sometimes. And not that, like, I only want, like, light and funny things, but... You know, like, Superman and Lois can get serious, but it never feels dour.
Right.
And then there's Legends, and I'm like, why would I watch this, like, super serious, like, I am nothing but angst? When I'm like, you know, instead I could watch people just eat endless bowls of mushroom curry and regret it. Like, why would I watch one if I had the other?
Exactly. Mushroom curry.
Not that you can't watch both, but, you know, you get it.
Yep. I was, you know, although I have to say, once again... Harkening back to that mushroom curry gag,
yeah.
I wasn't sure if they were ever going to, like, as I was watching the episode, I thought, are they going to call this? Is there going to be some payoff, or are they just going to, like, cut back to the restaurant with, like, an increasing number of empty plates or bowls?
Yeah, I figured that's all they were going to do with it.
Yeah, me too. I was actually when Zari actually mentions it, I was almost disappointed. I was like, no, don't call it out. Just let the plates pile up. Let Nate be the only person eating, please.
I also do love that they solved one issue I think most people had with the first episode of the season.
Ooh.
Which is it made no sense for Ava to be, like, blackout drunk.
That is true.
Of all the characters that were, like, confused and all this, like, Ava was just, like, blackout drunk. It was like, what, like... That is not in line. It's like, well, maybe it was such a big night, I guess. And then this time, you know, you see that she just grabbed everyone else's drinks because that's what I have to do now to forget you guys.
That was pretty great. Once again, I love how their plan, which was barely a plan, fell apart pretty much instantly.
Every time.
And then all...
Like every variation of it.
Yeah. And then... But it was... And the stakes, you know, normally in a plot in which plans fail, like, it means that the stakes have to ramp up. But
right.
But in this, it kind of just diminished the stakes every single time. And the entertainment or the pleasure was in watching these, like, repeated attempts, which you just knew, like, oh, this is going to fail too. Oh, so
yeah, I think the hardest laugh outside of, like, just the Snake Plissken bit, the hardest laugh of the episode for me really was the, like, Sarah's, like, doing the stuff and suddenly something blips. And she's like, what was that? It's like, oh, no, those idiots are trying to save me. Like, it's just the instant realization.
Right.
That, like, oh, the time stream is warping. Oh, god damn it. It was just somehow perfect.
Yeah. That moment and Zari's reaction to Snake Constantine.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Bye. This was all great fun. But Batwoman is going goodbye in an episode, for the season. Things are looking bad for the Bat team, but I think they'll pull it.
Sure.
I think they'll pull it out.
I mean, we're going to end up with Batwing. My guess is that we'll end up with, like, Kate staying on but changing her name. I don't know if they'll actually use, like, Red Hood, but something like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where she'll be kind of this other Bat figure and they'll give her a different name.
Right.
But she won't actually be Batwoman anymore. And she'll go fight crime somewhere else type of thing. And I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah. Although, excitedly, I forget now because I haven't watched, like, an episode or two. I know they're supposed to be in Cluemaster.
Oh.
And with Cluemaster, and it might be this last episode, I haven't watched it in a couple episodes, so I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
I've been kind of, like, just, you know, following some reviews and being like, shit, I have to watch these. but also that means we get Stephanie Brown, which I love me some Stephanie Brown.
Fair enough.
Anyway. We also had some Superman and Lois.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what you think of the the brother plot, the family, Kryptonian family plot now.
It is not what I expected.
Okay.
I thought it was really well done. It's a great... Well, also, it's kind of fun in that it kind of calls back to some... They're setting up some more 90s stuff, which is fascinating to me, given that they have Steel in there. Like, you bring in John Henry Irons, and you're like, okay, well, that's fine. But then they bring in the Eradicator.
Right.
And I'm just like, how much weird, like, 90s, like, Death of Superman stuff are we going to bring in? And I'm here for all of it. But...
Oh, that's right. That's where I knew the Eradicator.
Yeah. And again, like, eventually, like, it takes a while before it takes its own form. But yeah, so we have the Eradicator. Like, I like the whole, like, evil version. I mean, yes, it's that well-worn trope, but it actually works well here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't know. Like, it works for how they're using it, given that the focus of the show is family. Specifically, it works really well. I think if that wasn't this show, it wouldn't work.
I agree, yeah.
But I will say this last episode... Like, well, actually, the previous episode, I thought it was fantastic to bring in, like, Lara, even just, you know, through Lana's body type of thing. Because the show, like, Superman Mythos always makes the big deal out of Jor-El and Pa Kent.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it interesting that the show is making most of its meat off of the mothers.
Yeah, that is true.
So that's a nice change. But this episode, yes, it was the whole, like, picking through his memories bit. But holy shit, like, the first, like, what, half of this episode? More than half? Was some of the best, like, referencing comics and movies and old TV shows and everything. Just such a great, like, look at the Lois and Clark relationship.
Yeah, I thought that was, I love that bit. That was some of the best. That was, like, some of the best stuff from the series so far. Just that first.
Yeah.
The first half of the episode. Absolutely. I knew that it couldn't last. Because, you know, it wasn't long before I'm like, okay, this is obviously Morgan Edge, you know, rooting, or somebody rooting around in Clark's memories.
I didn't actually make that leap. I went to just, it was like him remembering stuff as like his you know, hologram Jor-El. Just like, dude. You know, type of thing.
Okay, because that's what I thought at first, and then there's that scene where he takes out the, I don't know the name of the particular villain, can't recall, but the sort of the Nazi and the steampunk Nazi. And then there's that sort of flickering shadow figure.
Right, yeah, and the shadow thing happens before that, too, I think.
Oh, it does? Okay, I only noticed
maybe?
It there.
Maybe? I don't remember. But yeah, like, either way, I was just like, okay, like, that's... Like, I thought that was the Jor-El bit, that's all.
Okay. I figured that had to be... I was thinking, that's Jor-El, or this is, you know, Morgan Edge. Yeah, you know, up to some shenanigans.
Right.
And I love that moment where he sort of steps just sort of outside of his own memory, and it keeps on playing with Lois.
Yeah, that was weirdly creepy.
That was a really clever moment.
Yeah.
That was excellent stuff. It's funny, I follow on Twitter, Adam Malinger, who wrote the previous episode. He's a writer's assistant on the show. I got a credit. But he was writing that one, partly in response, like all about, you know, Clark's mom, partly in response to his own father who died of COVID. So he's sort of, you know, saying sort of, I don't know, I mean, using, you know, Clark's mother in this case, but
right,
sort of exploring, he was exploring his sort of like his feelings of loss and grief through that episode, which I thought was really was really nice, so, which I think is partly why it was really heartfelt.
Oh yeah, no, and again, like, it's that when, and I said this on Twitter, like, one of my favorite things about the show is that you could feel that everyone involved, right, like, and I mean everyone. Like, directors, writers, you know, fucking boom operators, the actors, like, they just like Superman. You know, it's like, they just think he's keen. Like they just, they actually do just like the character.
I think
and
so.
Along with that comes that ability to just willingly be earnest and not be afraid of being earnest.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what Superman usually calls for. It's the only way to really approach the material, and that kind of shines through in that episode.
Agreed.
And again, like with that whole relationship bit, like the only way to pull those scenes off is to be earnest.
Oh, hold on. Hold on a sec. Okay. Sorry, YouTube started playing while I was while you were talking, and I was like, "What? What is going on?"
Shut up, YouTube.
Why?
Enough
why
of your shenanigans.
Why is Adam suddenly talking about Tarkovsky? What's going on here? What is paused video?
But yeah, no, Superman and Lois is again just such a delightful fucking show.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that weird caveat of like they keep missing chances to mention Supergirl. I am convinced there's something else going on. Not that like it's in its own continuity because they're not doing that. They're very much in the Arrowverse, you know, post crisis. There were changes,
mm-hmm. Right?
But originally, Supergirl was supposed to air, and then Superman and Lois was supposed to start, and that they were writing this season knowing what happened at the end of Supergirl.
Ah.
So I feel like there's some, like, they might have edited out a few mentions, and I think they actually did edit out, like, one mention, possibly because it spoiled something.
Hmm.
From late in the season of Supergirl that we're now not going to get until after the season of Superman and Lois. So, you know, COVID is just causing trouble for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm wondering if there's, because about John Diggle, like David Ramsey popped up in a recent episode of Batwoman.
Right, and he's going to be popping up in Flash and Superman and Lois.
Okay, that was my question. Is he going to show up in Superman and Lois?
Yes, he is doing his little tour. He directed an episode of Superman and Lois already.
I believe
he directed an episode of Flash. But he's also supposed to guest star on all three shows.
Cool. So if he's going to guest star on Superman and Lois, well, I guess it's going to be the last...
I think it's going to be like this next one.
Yeah, which is coming up on the... I think there's a bit of a break for a couple of weeks, and then we're going to get...
Yeah, I think so too.
Huh. Well,
let's double check. But yeah, I believe he's supposed to show up the next episode of... I don't think he's showing up on Legends, though, because it's Legends.
Right.
Yeah, there's no new Superman and Lois this week. I think it's next week.
Okay. Good enough. I'm looking forward to that.
And apparently this week's Legends is a Western again, an Old West mission.
All right, stressed Western, I believe is the... Yes, that works for me. one thing I love on the AV Club that the reviewer there, like, with every season they keep a running tally of, like, ranking the episode titles.
I mean, it's not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea. And I have to say, these episode titles so far are decent, but I mean last season's episode titles have to have been some of my favorites so far.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, Mortal Kombat stands out for me. Yeah.
It was a choice. Legends of Meow Meow, but you know.
yes, of course.
There was also, by the way, some Flash. I think I'm an episode behind. But we have our first, like, post-Cisco episode.
Oh, man.
And it's a fine episode. And, you know, it of course involves a lot of, like, but I don't know if I can replace Cisco because it had to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they'll move on.
I'm sure they will. Well, it's a shame. A shame.
But, yeah, no, the show finished its first little thing, and now its second kind of half of the season so far is just sort of going, I don't know. I am sure that'll resolve into something, but it hasn't yet, and that's fine. Like, I'm fine with little one-off weird episodes.
Yeah. I feel like our Flash commentary is not up to the same spec as our other episode show commentaries.
Yeah.
It's like Flash. It happened. That's a thing. But, I mean, that's kind of the show at this point anyway.
Right. I mean, that's just kind of where it is. Anyway, there was also, however, some Loki.
Yes, a double Loki extravaganza.
Yes.
2 and 3. So I find the reaction to episode 3 kind of fascinating. People I've on the internet seem to either really love it or they didn't. I thought as a Doctor Who episode it was pretty good.
I thought, I mean, sure, but I think as a follow-up to this is what Cosmic Marvel looks like between Guardians of the Galaxy and Taika's stuff with Thor. I thought it actually finally merged the two really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the aesthetic of Lamentis, the sort of the purple and green lighting, sort of all the styles of, like, you know, the building, the architecture and the clothing.
Right.
I was like, wow, they've just got the Marvel Universe, the Cosmic Marvel Universe, just, like, nailed at this point.
Right. And I thought it was a good idea. Like, I mean, it's a 6-episode show, right? So we have our first episode that goes, like, here's the basic concept.
Mm-hmm.
Our second episode kind of goes, like, here's what you think the threat is.
Uh-huh.
And our third episode goes, here's the character.
Right. That's exactly.
Plus some, like, at least one important plot bit.
Yes.
And then we could, you know, be off to the races. Like, I think it did a really good job, and I do like the fact that every episode feels like an episode. It doesn't feel like they're trying to do the, look, it's a movie.
It's,
you know what I mean? They're trying to instead do a TV show.
Yes, I know what you mean. And they're keeping it to, like, you know, the 42 to 45 minute mark. Yeah, so they're writing it to, like, the particular, you know, format. I quite liked episode 3.
Yeah.
Although there was some, now that I've been writing scripts, I could kind of see some of the seams on this one, where they had to sort of make sure that the audience was following along, and in a really good script, you don't need to do that. But, you know, if you have to do it...
In a really good script, in something that is aimed a little bit smaller, you don't have to do that, frankly. When you're aiming as far and as wide as Marvel does, you have... I mean, all the Marvel stuff, right? Like, even things like Civil War. Not Civil War. The Winter Soldier, which sounds mean. Like, their political thriller. They still took pains to be like... Also, here is exactly what's going on.
Right.
At least twice. Because, you know, any mainstream global marketed movie that wants to try to hit as large an audience as possible has to hit those notes.
No, I get what you're saying.
I think they're doing that with the TV show. It's smart.
Yep.
But I feel what you're saying from a script point of view. Like, yes, it's annoying.
Yeah, and I think, like, for just for, like, a small example that kind of stood out to me, because I watched it once by myself, and I watched it again with Alan. During the fight in the train car, when they're mm-hmm. battling it out, Loki gets thrown through the window, and then Sylvie follows after him. But she literally, like, sees him go out and then says, the tempad, and then, like jumps out after him. Like, it's one of those things where it's like you had to, like, say the tempad so we don't mm-hmm. forget what's going on. And
well,
honestly,
I think less we don't forget what's going on, and more, I mean, in that specific instance, I think
right,
it was more the
specific,
why would she, you know, before people were like, well, why would she jump after him? You know, it's like, remember the MacGuffin?
Yes.
Exactly. And again, like, it's been at least 10 minutes since we've named the MacGuffin. We have to name the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Like, keep the audience on the same rails.
Yeah, no, I get it. I think it's just because, like I said, like, now that I'm writing a freaking script every week,
right.
I come up against, you know, the exact same issue. Like, oh, now we have to, like, drop this information at this point,
uh-huh.
and make sure that the audience remembers this bit for the next thing to, like, you know, just sort of intuitively make sense. So when I hear it happen, when I see it,
yeah,
it sort of it makes me sort of flinch a bit, like, oh god, okay. But I don't think it's
one of those weird things of like, I don't know, it's a part of the car, if that makes sense.
Right.
That you're just like, yeah, that's part of the car, right? Like, you can't escape having that. There's no escaping the necessity of it.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
And so I don't really, like, I catch it when it happens, like, oh, well, that's where this is. But it doesn't even make me flinch anymore, because it's like, if it's done well at all, it will stick out to you if you're used to dealing with it.
Yeah.
But it's also done smooth enough that sometimes you won't even notice it, regardless.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that for most people it was like, it was unnoticed or you know.
Right. And again, like the way she did it was like her own, you know, you have it so that like she realizes it and just says it out loud because that's the way TV works because you can't hear her thoughts.
Yeah, this is true. This would be true.
So, yeah, I thought it worked. I said I did see a bunch of people who were upset with it because they felt it was like a bottle episode, and I mean it really isn't, but I know what they mean.
Yeah, no, there's not a lot happens, and I think in this one,
one location planet wise, which for this show is a new thing.
Right. They want like I saw somebody comment saying, this was a subpar episode. The fight scenes were meh. Although I don't know why you would say that there. I thought they were fine. They're good. And there's only one piece of, you know, of plot information revealed. I'm like, A, that wasn't plot information, so shut up. And B, is this how you watch television for like, is it like a Pez dispenser where like, oh, I didn't get the flavor of Pez I wanted.
Ever since Lost.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. It's like,
it really is that like, it's transactional now, right?
Yeah.
Did you get something like any type of show that they think might have a mystery?
Mm-hmm.
Is now, did you get enough X during, you know, like, did this move forward enough? Did that move forward enough? Who cares about character development? Did this move?
Yeah.
And it's frustrating. And I mean, they can all go to hell.
Yeah. I mean, come on, let's watch this for like, you know, Loki and Sylvie sitting on the train car, arguing about who gets to sit where, and then, you know, talking about their mothers. That is a lot more interesting than some sort of bit of backstory about the Time Variance Authority. Well, that was pretty good. I did enjoy that sort of revelation about the TVA. So
right. I did also see a Twitter exchange, speaking of the train thing, that I wish I could find now, because it is one of the like funniest examples of just, oh, some people should not be doing this.
Watching shows and talking about them on Twitter.
Yes, frankly. Kate Herron had, you know, mentioned that she was really glad that she got to put in that, like, little bisexual Loki reference.
Right.
And somebody was like, you know, like, why did you have to, like, bury it there? Why not, like, why have him just say it? Why not show it? Like, when he first, like, sees the TV agent, why isn't he, like, you know, like, hey, guy, you look pretty hot. Hey, girl, you do too. And someone was like, well, because that is, like, the worst dialogue I've ever heard. And the guy was just like, you know, I think it was fine. I don't see what your problem is. And I was like, oh, my God, he was serious. Like, it was just that moment of just like, weren't just like, why didn't you do something terrible? You actually meant literally this terrible thing. Okay.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. Okay. I'll tell you some stuff after this episode finishes taping.
I'm sure. anyway. No, I think Loki is a whole lot of fun. And, you know, it is exactly what it wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, like Ragnarok was. But can we discuss the evil thing with all of these shows?
The evil thing?
The evil thing that Netflix is doing too, frankly. So is Apple TV. So is HBO Max. Depending on the show, so is Amazon. All of these great streaming shows that people love, no one's doing physical media releases. And on the one hand, you're like, okay, like, you get it, right? Because they, you know, but on the other hand, do you realize the big problem? Libraries and archives.
Yeah.
It's like, just fuck you. Like, they just want to keep you on teat forever if you ever want to rewatch this thing.
Oh yeah, and I mean, when I was, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, I mean, I relied on the local library for not just books, but most of like all the art house movies that I knew growing up.
Right.
They're all from the library.
Right. At some point, out that like they could do like a limited DVD pressing that they offer only to libraries.
That would be delightful.
Because if people are like, people will rip them. It's like, sure, people also torrent your show.
Yeah.
But you open up again, like you allow for archiving and you open up your viewership to people who can't afford to see it, but have access to libraries, because this is what libraries are for.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually curious as to what the sort of the age of streaming and Kindle and whatnot, you know, e-readers, has done to like library sort of like borrowing rates. I know the libraries
it's actually
have
increased
like
them for a lot of them because, well, it's increased and decreased them because, I mean, you know, the problem is like they have to pay for a copy. They have to pay for copies of digital stuff multiple times because the license expires.
Okay.
And it's like they have to pay for it after so many like reads and all that. Like it and it's expensive. But they do digital lending.
There's Canopy, for example, for streaming media, and there's some. I have an app on my phone for like borrowing digital books and so on.
Yeah, there's one for comics.
Yep.
So I mean, on like it's that thing of like people who go to libraries for physical copies and all this are not much lower, I would imagine, in general. People who know about the digital apps and have access to that stuff, it's probably a little, you know, they're using it, I'm guessing. But mm-hmm. again, the problem is it stresses out the libraries because it costs more.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I mean, look, just like if you remember the lawsuits in the 80s around VHS and cassettes.
Oh, yes.
With you can't make your own home copies. All media companies, I mean, they tried this with the DVDs, where they tried to sell those DVDs that have a coating that degrades over 24 hours.
Right.
You know, no media company wants you to own anything. No software company wants you to own anything. They want you to rent it. Because then they can always make money off of you.
Yes.
That's the bottom line. And they are happy to destroy things like libraries and all this because they wrongly see libraries as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know, you know, creators, you know, comic people, prose people, whatever, who view libraries as a problem. Because, well, they're going to borrow from the library. It's not a sale. It's like, the library has to buy them. And the more people who read your shit, like, the more copies the libraries get. And no, it's not like a one-to-one, but also just like, fuck you. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. It's like, you know, when people who I've heard people say that, I'm like, so did you never benefit from libraries growing up? I mean, you did, even if you don't think you did. But I mean, if you didn't spend your time in libraries, you know, growing up, fuck you anyway. That's just my feeling.
Yeah.
But yes, indeed, yeah, evil, and I do miss like the sort of the prevalence of, I don't know, I would love to see more things on, you know, on Blu-ray. I mean, the whole sort of library question aside, I miss like really nice Blu-ray or, you know, DVD releases of, you know, just with cover art and, you know, and extras and so on and so forth.
Right. A few people, of course, have been recently going like, hey, why aren't all the DVD extras on, like, you know, streaming media? It's like, well, because they're often owned by the company that produced the DVD. Not necessarily the studio that produced the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not always the same.
Right.
You know?
And there are some cases.
There were some cases, but, and again, they don't tend to include all the same extras just because that just costs money and they don't want to give you things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stupid. Like, you should be able to pick your audio source when you're watching a movie if there was a commentary.
Oh, yeah.
But but they don't want you to do that because, you know, and again, like, I think that there's a lot of stuff, like, I get, like, I understand it from a pure money-making perspective, right? But also, I think as much as people love Ted Lasso, let's just say, if it had been released on Blu-ray, like, Apple would make an extra, like, $1 million off that show without breathing hard.
I would think so.
And yet, they won't do it because they want more subscribers. And they don't seem to understand, like, what that will do is it will force people to start just pirating their shit anyway just to have archival backups.
Yeah.
Like, not even necessarily to watch. Like, they'll still pay to watch it, but they'll still have these archival backups.
I've gotten into the habit of doing that just because there are times when I'm like, I would like to watch X movie. And so I go to Netflix to watch it, and, oh, the deal's expired. It's no longer available. I'm like, well, that sucks. That's... Cause, yeah. And but, I mean, it just, like, things just vanish down the digital memory hole. So I was like, no, I would like a copy. I would like a backup copy. Thank you. So, and there you go.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like, it's the number of things that just have vanished completely.
Mm-hmm.
Never, you know, possibly never to return is staggering.
And yet you can still watch Interstellar on streaming services. Why doesn't that disappear? Damn it, down a black hole.
We've tried.
Wouldn't that be nice?
It keeps coming back. yeah, I, you know, and then of course there's the, like, this thing moved to this service, and how many services are you supposed to pay for? Like, oh, remember, we all laugh, of course, like, because we all, I think everyone in the world predicted it, but yep. Remember when it was like, you know, Netflix, it was going to do away with cable.
Right.
And it's going to be so much cheaper. And now it's like, no, it's the same, like, you know, whatever, 100 odd bucks a month you were paying for cable, just you're paying it for all these other services, and you still don't actually get those channels.
Yep. It's just the exact same model, just in a slightly different format.
Yep.
It's absolutely fucking bizarre. I'm actually currently paying for Apple Plus, and for the amount of shows that I actually watch on Apple Plus, that even there, I'm like, why am I even shelling out $5 or $6 a month for this?
Yeah, I mean, Ted I'm not Lasso's actually paying great. For it yet because I said I'm not because, you know, you get the whole, like, oh, you get like a free year with thing.
Right. No, I did.
And I
did
think
not
mine's gonna like run out like right before Ted Lasso season 2, and I'll be like, fine, here's another $5. Like, and I, you know, I'll pay for it for as long as, like, I think, you know, when there's Ted Lasso around.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, there are some really worthwhile shows on Apple Plus. I've been watching Lisey's Story, which actually is a, I don't know, it has a lot of Stephen King-y things in it that I'm a little tired of, but it's just kind of hallucinatory and quite beautiful. So I'm watching it for that reason. So that'll do. And I have a trial to Shudder from Prime Video because I spend a month watching some weird ass horror films and then try and remember not to renew.
yeah, I mean, I have too many of them. Like, and there are some, like Hulu, that I re-up like once or twice a year for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And watch Letterkenny. And yeah. Then I drop it again.
That only makes sense.
Yeah. Why should I pay for this thing if I'm never going to use it?
Precisely.
And, like, that is the kind of funny thing to me, is that, like, I just... Like, some of them I have and I pay for every month, and I swear to God, I could not tell you, like, why. Like, I don't... Because I don't think about them, so... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just, it hurts me, but I'm like, I don't want to keep dropping and adding and dropping and adding.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them. Because I know, like, if I'm bored, say, like, you know, Netflix, between Netflix, Disney, and HBO, like, if I'm ever, like, I can't think of anything to watch, I will totally find something.
For example, you can watch Manifest.
I could watch Manifest.
I have not watched Manifest. I am now up to episode 8 of Manifest. There is something hilarious about that show. There are some overtly Christian themes, but it also feels like a lot of Christian media, where they're people who running it that don't seem to have any idea how the real world works.
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of implausible things happen, but they also don't seem to have any understanding of how story works. The storytelling is really weird as well. It's sometimes in good ways, sometimes in really hilariously awful ways. And the actors all look like they're from, it's like they're all like from different shows. It's like they all sort of like woke up one morning on a particular show and then woke up the next morning on Manifest. And someone was like poised over them with a script going, say these lines. You're going to walk out and somebody's going to come to you, say these lines. They're like, oh, okay. It's just half the scenes just feel like these like they're sort of like other characters under obscure duress. I can't stop watching the show for that reason. Although I think my Manifest Jones energy is wearing off, fortunately.
That's fair. I was watching Burn Notice. I'm in the last season. I have like I don't know. Maybe less than like I have like 7 episodes to go, something like that, and I just haven't had the energy.
Yeah,
I'm just petering out right at the end. Although Mythic Quest apparently the second season ended, so I get to go back and actually watch it now.
That's
as much as I tend to not like binging. Weirdly, that show I like binging.
That's good. That's on my list of bingeables now that I have my Apple Plus subscription. So there you go.
Yeah.
Before we're hitting about the hour, but there's something I just wanted to mention briefly because it struck me as phony. I was skimming YouTube the other day, and it offered up to me a video of Olivia Rodrigo talking about her like 18 favorite or essential songs for her 18th birthday, now that she turned 18. Okay. And some of them were, you know, pretty modern stuff. There are a couple of Taylor Swift songs on there. There was a White Stripes song, whatever. But some of them were like Carole King's Tapestry. It's Too Late by Carole King, and Iron Man by Black Sabbath. So, and nice. I looked, and I'm like, these are from like 50 and 51 years ago, and it's,
oof.
Yeah, I know. So for an 18-year-old today, I mean, it's you know. Eclectic musical taste, but it's perfectly plausible. Like that you could like Iron Man from Black Sabbath, and somebody could come out with Iron Man, and it would be like, oh, it's a little retro, but it's, you know, still a viable sort of like grungy metally tune.
Well, what you have to remember though is that like the people who own the radio stations, whether or not they, you know, have run an algorithm to play shit and all this, are the people for whom let's have a classic rock station that just still plays all that shit.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Like, none of that shit has ever vanished. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like if someone was like, here's this obscure 50s band that, like, used to, when we were kids, let's say, be on the oldie station, but that was the only place they existed.
Yeah.
You know? Then I would be like, oh, well, okay, fine. That's an interesting pull. But nowadays, it's like, oh, I turned on the classic rock station one afternoon, I heard the song.
Oh, exactly. So, like, so all these things are, like, accessible, you know, and they sound hyper accessible, and because of the sort of we're soaked in this constant hyper accessibility, these things still, like, people like musicians still draw on these for influence, and so we get this sonic soup that it all kind of sounds like, okay, this could still be,
and I can tell you why. I mean, it's terrible, but I can tell you part of why.
Sure.
Because that was still an era where things weren't digitally snapped to a grid.
Yeah.
Where you didn't have just, like, a drum machine, like, playing on a grid. You had, you know, people who were playing weird time signatures by accident but making it work.
Right.
Where you didn't have vocal fixes, so you had to, like, pan manually. You had to actually, like, hit notes and layer. And it's just not that, like, oh, music then is better than music now. I buy a lot of modern music that I love just as much as I love older stuff, sure. Right? But there is a quality to a good chunk of older music that you can't find now. Mm-hmm. Because the technology has marched on, right? And you have new people doing stuff creatively now that you couldn't do for any number of reasons then.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also fascinating. But there is a level of kind of rawness of just doing the thing that you don't find anymore.
Yeah, no, that's I think you're right. Like, outside of, like, garage bands and stuff like that, like, recorded,
right.
Like, professionally recorded music is a very different animal now.
It's why I think a lot of dance stuff is going back to disco and funk, because you can snap disco and funk mostly to a grid and not notice.
Mm-hmm.
Which is terrible. Disco, at least. As much as I love disco, you can take a disco beat and snap to a grid and it won't hurt the beat much.
No, that's true.
And then you can play with it and do something new, but it still feels like you're playing with older stuff, and that lets you bring in different things. Who is it? There's somebody I noticed that was doing something I thought was interesting. I cannot think of the name at all. Help me, Rhonda. Dua Lipa does right. A lot of stuff that's very dance music forward, obviously, and a lot of her dance music stuff is disco and funk inspired.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And all of her beats, like all of her drum lines, are, you know, programmed.
Right.
But her bass player and her guitar player, like wah pedal involved, are live. And, like, she understands intrinsically that, like, you can take this part of disco and you can quantize it. This has to be real or it will never sound quite right.
Yeah. That's
because it has to drift.
Yeah.
And I think that's why she's so successful. Like, there is that thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny.
There you
go.
That's
funny.
My personal take.
No, that's I agree. And it's funny with Rodrigo, because a few of her songs are sort of heavily produced and I think snap to that grid.
Sure.
But for example, a lot of her sort of acoustic, sort of more sort of folky material on her album, you know, I've seen reviews where they actually talk about the fact that you can hear her finger like sliding, you know, down to another chord. And it's,
people used to get mad and try to like learn how to play without any like fret noise.
Yeah.
And now it's a badge of honor.
Oh, I know. Now it's a mark of authenticity, right? Because it means
I've always liked it personally.
Me too. I do. But I mean, it means that they're actually playing the instrument. I mean,
right.
Yeah. I mean, it's still possible to whatever, but let's see it here. But anyway, I was saying a couple things. One writer that I really quite liked, or still like, he's dead now, Mark Fisher. He had the blog K-Punk for God knows how long. But he one of his obsessions was the way music, pop music, had changed over the decades. And his contention was that there was no really sort of innovative new music since, like, drum and bass in the 90s. Like, this... For him, things kind of stopped there, or rather, not for him, things stopped there. He contended that for the world, you know, things right. kind of stopped there, and there is very little new music that actually truly innovated. And he attributed it to what he called the slow cancellation of the future, which is, you know, I think his term for cultural stagnation in the wake of digital hyper availability and, you know, the crushing forces of mass market consumerism. But it's one of the things that's fascinating for me is that when I thought, okay, Rodrigo's 18, she's calling back to a song 50 years ago, and it's still something that could conceivably be written and played today, and people right. would still be like, yeah, yeah, okay, that's contemporary. And then, but I turned 18 in 1989, and I thought. And so I went and I looked like the top hits of 1939, 50 years ago. And it's literally like
right.
A Tisket, A Tasket, Summertime, Alexander's Ragtime Band. I mean, these are all great tunes, but if I was, but if, But nobody in the late 80s could like play like Alexander's Ragtime Band and have people go, oh yeah, that sounds contemporary. I mean, it was just absolutely different. Like the technologies were different. But there is sort of like the short pop piece was still like a 20th century pop sensibility was still there with these things.
But also a lot of the accessibility.
Different. Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. I think that if in the 80s we had recordings of all this stuff.
Right.
But it wasn't, you could just sit down and play whatever of it you wanted at any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that people would be way more into older stuff then, too.
Absolutely.
Honestly.
I remember
going, you get cassettes of stuff, or your parents would have, you know, LPs, and you would listen to that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, my feeling is that, yeah, not that if we're hyper available, not that people would just be into it, but that music in the late 80s would sound more like it. Like there would have been less change overall in the musical zeitgeist because this would have been always, because the digital world renders everything kind of present and suspended in this sort of timeless state.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, you know, disco, of course, and then because disco was, you know, queer and not white.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, the terrible racist fought back with, of all things, yodeling. And, I mean, let's be honest, they did.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, all the prog rock shit, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Was the answer to that, and the answer to, like, prog rock, because you'd already had some, like, classic rock stuff, but the answer to prog rock was, let's strip away the bullshit, and you end up basically cycling to the 80s through it, with a sort of synthesis of everything going on at the time. You have the funk in there, you have, you know, but it's muffled through, it's no longer bass forward, it's now guitar forward again. You know, you have the rise of the effects pedals in the 80s.
Yep.
And the start of digital, you know, like, drum machines. Digital production.
Oh, yeah.
Shaped a whole lot of music. I mean, one of my favorite weird notes is that there is a drum noise that is very much from the 80s that was essentially, like, I forget who invented it, but they invented it by mistake.
Oh, really?
Because they were trying to mic a drum, and the way they had to do it, like, causes this very specific noise that, like, it reverses the gate.
Okay.
Like, in the fill sound and all this, and it became a thing. And then, like, every song had it, and then it vanished because everyone got sick of it, and then it recently came back because all these kids grew up listening to 80s tunes as, like, retro, and they liked the sound, and they didn't hear it in current music.
I typed in 80s drum sound, and here we go. Yep. There's gated reverb. There we go. Yep. Nifty.
I think it was for a Phil Collins set, actually.
I was going to say, because, I mean, some of the most iconic sort of 80s sound is Phil Collins drumming.
Well, right, but it's... Yeah, it was... I think it was... Yep, it was Phil Collins. It was, 1979.
That would be...
It was Genesis.
It was in Genesis, okay. Interesting.
Yep. Yeah, no, Gated Reverb was a Genesis thing, weirdly enough.
Huh.
And it was Prince who, on some track or another, actually wanted to flip one of his drums. Because, you know, usually there's the decay, right?
Right.
You get the hit and then the decay. And he flipped it.
Oh, nice.
So you get the decay into the hit, and it's on, like, three or four songs right around the 1999 era of Prince. And then you realize, like, after he did it, it was everywhere for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Because it was Prince, and he was right. but anyway. So, yeah, a lot of weird shit like that. But then... Yeah. Go look up the history of Gated Reverb because it's fascinating.
Yeah, I've got it on the internet right now. But you know, it's funny how like when I was, you know, a teenager in the 80s and how I reflexively hated disco and not realizing two things. One, disco kind of rules. But also, most of the big producers of disco simply moved into 80s pop music anyway. Like, probably, yeah. I would say, I hate disco, but I mean, probably I would say, but I, half the tracks are, like, could probably be like Nile Rodgers tracks, for example, right? So
right.
It's just, they just whitened it up, basically. And
And then they took just, they basically split the funk back out.
Yeah.
Dropped the high end.
Mm-hmm.
Left the rhythm in, and then added some like fuzz on guitars.
Yeah.
And called it rock.
It's
kind of sad.
It is sad, and it's particularly sad that I didn't even notice, that most of us didn't even realize it at the time.
Right. No, I didn't notice either for years. One of the most fascinating things, of course, is like, you know, funk itself is a form of jazz, realistically, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a band called Sissy Street, C-I-S-S-I-E. They are a French funk and jazz band. And they are doing some like very, very like French street jazz type things and then adding the funk back in.
Ooh.
And it is a fascinating thing of like, I don't think they mean to, but they managed to completely deconstruct and reconstruct funk like 7 times during the album.
Oh, nice.
So, anyway, we are past the hour mark.
All right.
So we should go and listen to some music. Well, our music, and then, you know, go find some good music and listen to that.
Woo! Music!
Woo!